It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Good afternoon on this Thursday afternoon. Sad to hear about Dame Diana Rigg. I'm sure a lot of men listening would have had teenage crushes on her in the Avengers. Used to love that. Was it on a Saturday evening, Sunday evening? And he had that hat that he used as a weapon. Great memories, fond memories. What are we going to do about COVID-19? I see those full page ads in the papers today. We need to reduce COVID-19 infections. COVID-19 has been a major disruption to our country and our lives. Ireland is now learning to live with the virus. However, infection rates are increasing again, particularly in Dublin and Limerick. And then you might have seen it. Maybe you didn't if you didn't get the paper. But they have the county table, you know, the league table. So the county rates per 100,000 new cases and the trend. And not a league table you want to be top of, but Dublin is there. So 67.8 is the rate per 100,000 new cases, 913. And that's over the last 14 days. Limerick is in second place. Kildare's in third place. Then Leitrim, Offaly, Monaghan. And Sligo is at the bottom of the table. 4.6 is the rate per 100,000. Now, I would imagine the thinking behind this is that we look at this league table and we say to ourselves, well, we're in that county, we're in Dublin, so we need to work harder because we want to get to the bottom of the table like Sligo. That's probably the thinking. It's a little bit subtle for me, I would think. It's a little bit subtle. I think as humans, we need to be told what to do. And there's a lot of nudging going on and a lot of suggestions and a lot of mixed messaging. And I know it was easier at the beginning when everybody was told not to go more than 2 kilometres, then not to go more than 5 kilometres, not to leave your county, all of those things. It was a lot easier. But I think if they're going to take out a full page ad in national newspapers, there, it needs to be a stronger message than just a league table of counties. I don't know what the answer is. I don't know what the answer is. And then they changed the woman's voice as well, who gives the information about COVID-19 on the radio ads. I thought that was a mistake. Now they have a female and a male voice. Very good voices, very good actors. But we need consistency, don't we? We need consistency. Yeah. And then to lock down Dublin, they're not going to do that, are they? They're not going to do that. And I read a piece by Paul Cullen in the Irish Times today. And he is saying a thing that a lot of people have said to me and I've thought myself, is obviously NPHET and the people in charge have a lot more information than they're sharing with us. So they have granular information. They have really intricate bits of information that we don't have. They're not sharing with us, but they can see trends that they're not sharing with us. And as a result, they know that things are quite serious in Dublin and Limerick, and that's why they've highlighted those two counties in this one-page ad. But they need to be a little bit more specific about what they want us to do with the statistics they're giving us. Anyway, that's that. Yeah, Elliot Dallin. This is a very sad story. I read his article on Monday in The Guardian. He's 31 and he was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and he wrote an article on his diagnosis and how he was living with it in April. And I got a huge reaction, and The Guardian obviously went back to him and said, would you write another one? And it was published on Monday, and very sadly, Elliot died on Monday afternoon. And his family read the reaction to his article to him as he lay on his deathbed. But on Monday in that article, he writes that I'm hoping impending death now grants me the license to sound prematurely wise and overly grandiose. So he shares with us, the readers of his article, five things, five messages about living and life that he wants to pass on before he dies. So it might be a nice little legacy thing for Elliot Dallin to share them with you today. And we know a lot of them. The importance of gratitude. So he says the importance of friends and family, and even when he was at his lowest during chemotherapy and his debilitating symptoms, he was able to realise that he was lucky because he had amazing family and friends. It's the attitude of gratitude. Number two, a life if lived well is long enough, because none of us know when the curtains are going to be pulled on us, the rug pulled from underneath our feet. So we have to live life as if it's, you know, it's limited enough. That's a nice little message. Number three, he says, be vulnerable and connect to others. And he says, we live in a society that prizes capability and independence, two things that cancer often slowly strips away from you. This was naturally a very difficult pill for me to swallow, a healthy, able, late 20-something male, but having to allow myself to be vulnerable and accept help has given me the best 2 years of my life, which was pretty inconceivable at the time of diagnosis. And you see, particularly men, vulnerability is seen as a weakness. And of course, if you don't show a little bit of vulnerability, it's more difficult to connect with people. So that's a good message. Do something for others. And we read that day in, day out, that by doing something for others, be it volunteering, knocking into an elderly neighbour to ask if they need their, you know, their groceries collected, that it actually is something that makes your life a lot more fulfilling. And finally, he says, protect the planet. And him, as a young male, seeing the way the planet's going, wanted to, from his deathbed, plea with us to protect our planet. So that's it. May he rest in peace, Elliot Dallin, and our thoughts are with his family. And we do need to protect our planet because there's an audit from the World Wildlife Federation, the WWF, released today. You might have read it in some of the papers. Global populations of mammals, birds, fish, amphibians and reptiles plunged by 68% between 1970 and 2016. That's phenomenal. And in certain parts of the world, Latin America and the Caribbean, or the Caribbean, they recorded a fall of 94%. And this is man's effect on the planet. We're obliterating wildlife as we attempt to feed ourselves, clothe ourselves, with total disregard to who we share the planet with. And it's not just animals, it's, you know, plants, trees, all of that. And then fish as well, we're overfishing our seas. So if that wasn't a wake-up call, and we've been given so many over the years from people from Greta Thunberg to David Attenborough, but the fact that nearly 70% of mammals, birds, fish, amphibians and reptiles have disappeared from the planet in the last 50 years. That's a wake-up call. David Attenborough says, we require systematic shifts in how we produce food, create energy, manage our oceans and use materials. But above all, it requires a change in perspective. The wealthier nations have taken a lot and the time has now come to give, as in give back. And you would have thought that the last 6 months have allowed us to take stock of how we live and maybe change our habits. You would hope that's the case, but we don't know. Remains to be seen. That's that. Today, Alison Keating, psychologist, and Ray O'Neill, psychotherapist, are on the show, and they're offering you advice on your relationship problems. And if you want some free advice from them, anonymous advice, ray@rte.ie, and we'll be speaking to Ray and Alison after 4 o'clock. We've been talking about sheds on the show. I don't know where it started. Oh yeah, I cleaned out my shed there 2 weeks ago. Bid has been on. Bid, short for Biddy. And she says, this is my first time ever corresponding to a radio show, but your recent chat about sheds caught my attention. My name is Biddy, and I just want to say and tell you about my recently renovated shed and how much it means to me. I've downsized to a 2-bedroom townhouse from the country and really missed the extra room in my garden. So as time went on, I couldn't stay looking at the roller door of my shed from my kitchen window. That's like a garage door, isn't it? I felt it was caving in on me, so I decided to put in large patio doors instead of the roller door. Removed the galvanised roof, replaced it with well-insulated polycarbonate clear roof sheets. I then put in a stove, music system, so I could listen to Radio 1, table and chairs, and of course a wine rack. So it has transformed my social gathering 2 metres apart, of course, and has given me the headspace we all crave. Continued success with all the interesting topics. And she encloses photographs. That's like a front room, Biddy. That's not a shed. That's a front room. It looks amazing and cosy and lovely. And you've obviously put your own stamp on it. And I can see how it's become a little bolt hole, a little sanctuary for you and your friends and your little glass of wine and your stove. And then Biddy got back onto it. She said, sorry again, Ray, just a little after I sent the last email, I was thinking about my obsession with sheds, and I just realised it comes from childhood memories of my late father using his plane on timber, making handles for shovels, axes and beet forks. As he'd retired from the sugar factory and spent endless hours in the shed and asked I for a cobby house. How many people remember them? A cobby house. I spent as much time in that shed with my tea set and my imaginary friends, such happy days. So in the shed and asked I for a cobby house. Somebody will have to explain that to me, or Biddy, you might get back onto us and explain cobby house to me. Thank you very much. 51551 ray@rte.ie. We were talking about fundraisers yesterday, and we're going to be talking to Frank Greeley today. He's walking from Ballyhaunis to Dublin over 12 days, and we'll be catching up with him today. But we got an email from Caroline. She says, just to let you know about a fundraiser in a pair of Guinness slippers. John Quirk, jeweller from the town of Care in County Tipperary, cycled 8.5 kilometres on his mountain bike, ran 3.5 kilometres in a pair of Guinness slippers. I don't know the significance of that. He did it on Saturday morning, 5th of September, in a bid to raise funds for two local charities, Helping Mandy and Care Daycare Centre. Mandy is a wonderful 12-year-old girl from Care who has been diagnosed with leukaemia, but despite still going through lots of chemo and harsh treatments, she smiles through it all. And the good news, of course, and Mandy and her friends and family will know that the outcomes for leukaemia are, you know, they're very good these days. Care Daycare Centre is the other charity. They play a huge role in the heart of Care. GoFundMe, Caring for Care, is the GoFundMe page. And John has raised $7,000 already. John Quirk with his quirky fundraising efforts. And there's pictures of John being chased by a guard, running with Donald Trump, not the real one. And there's Mandy as well, smiling through it all. So well done, John. And hello to everybody down in Care, County Tipperary. 51551 ray@rte.ie. Can you give a shout out to our daughter, Carol Brady, who's 33 today? That's from parents Esther and Jim in Newtown, Kildare. And Esther used to bath me as a child. There you go. So she has seen parts of me that very few people have. It's sort of embarrassing when you meet people like that, isn't it? You know, as an adult. And, you know, because there was 9 of us. And my mum needed a bit of a dig out on a Saturday when we were all being bathed. And there was always rows to see who would go in first. Because, of course, if you went into the bath first, you got a clean bath water. And then if you were third or fourth, God only knows what you got. But anyway, hello, Esther and Jim. Can't believe that you've a 33-year-old. But happy birthday, Carl. Diana Rigg, RIP, was the only ever Mrs. James Bond. Great actress, beautiful lady. And that's from Sean Curry in Bellew, Rathfee, County Meath. And Ray, they need to get a message out to young people on TikTok. Young people don't read the papers or listen to Radio 1. You're right there. Also, they need to tell the people where exactly the cases are, town by town. Well, that's the point that Paul Cullen was making in the Irish Times today. And he's been brilliant across the last 6 months on COVID. And he asked the questions that need to be asked. But TikTok, because as we know, over the last couple of months, a large percentage of the people who've got the virus have been under 45. Now, not everybody under 45 is on TikTok, but a lot of them are. So there you go. There's your task today. If you know somebody who's on TikTok, get them to make a public information video about COVID and send it in to us, and we'll get on to the people in the HSE, Paul Reid and everybody, and see if they'll go with it. Yeah, the Avengers. Ah, yes. Steed was his name, wasn't it? In his bowler hat and his cane. What was Diana Rigg's character's name? They'll tell us now. You will. 51551. What was her name? Her character's name? There you go, rest in peace. Tonight on extra.ie at 8 o'clock, can we point you towards Mary Coughlan, an intimate gig with Mary Coughlan, FOC, free of charge on extra.ie. That's on tonight at 8 o'clock, and I'm sure she'll be singing songs from her new album and indeed her new single, which is this. 51551 RadioRTE.ie. Good afternoon. One. Mary Coughlan. That's brilliant. That's my favourite Mary Coughlan song in an awful long time. And she does sound like Dusty Springfield, which is a big compliment. And she's in concert, well, concert session, extra.ie, at 8 o'clock this evening, if you're a fan. Do you know the expression, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater? I do. It came from when everyone shared the bathwater in Victorian times. The baby will be the last to go, and at that stage, the water will be black and the baby will be hard to see. Thus, don't throw the baby out with the bath. Is that true? That's Marie in County Galway. Now I'm getting embarrassed now thinking of Esther, Carol, now Brady, bathing me when I was a young lad. Bought a wooden shed for my children for a playhouse. It was called and still is the Chubby Cottage. They're all adults now. But cobby was the word that Biddy used. Thanks, Martina. And Lorna's been on. She says, through the lockdown, my son, a Leaving Cert student, converted his dad's shed, 16 by 12, into his room. Insulated, lights, sound system and a pallet bed. He recycled everything he could find. He learned so much about life and lives out there now. Happy boy, only home for dinner. Lorna, I'd say that suits everybody. I see that Eurostat have released statistics, because that's what they do, about the age that people leave the family home right across Europe. The European average is 26.2 years and the average in Ireland is 27. So the average age that children leave the family home is 27, which is old compared to Sweden. Sweden has the lowest age, 17.8 years they're leaving the family home. How does that work up there in Sweden? Where do they go? Digs and then they just never go home. Denmark, 21. Finland, 21 as well. And then the oldest, Croatians, they hang on to mammy and daddy as long as they can. And they're 31 on average before they leave the family home. That's all very interesting, isn't it? Guy Garvey, lead singer with Elbow, is married to Diana Rigg's daughter. I didn't know that. She was Emma Peel in The Avengers, says Marianne County Clare. He's a lovely guy, Guy Garvey. He's a lovely guy, is Guy Garvey. He's the lead singer with Elbow. Great voice too. Thanks for that, Marion. 51551 ray at rte.ie.
Email ray at rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, as you know, and we've been trying to highlight on the show, it's a very tough time for the music industry in Ireland. But we spotted a lovely little plan to bring some live music to the country this winter in a safe and socially distant way. Concertina player Cormac Begley tweeted, I'm going to take my beloved camper van Beauty on a new journey. I'll organise small outdoor concerts in secret locations throughout the country. So we said we have to find out more about this. So we got Cormac Begley into the Radio na Gaeltachta studio in Ballyneagall, and he's on the line now. How are you doing, Cormac?
Alaba Harfads, Ray. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to talk to you again.
You too.
Yeah, so Beauty is the camper van.
Yes, I have an old camper van, an old 1979 Mercedes camper van that came in from Holland maybe 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And I've had it for about 3 years. And I've done it up recently with a friend of mine, Marco Waddock, here in West Kerry. And my plan is to do some outdoor concerts from Beauty in secret locations all around the country. So,
and I've been looking at Beauty, and it has an awning.
She does, yeah.
No less. Yeah. What's the Irish word for awnings?
I haven't a clue.
And it has Beauty featured on TV. It has.
It has recently, yeah. There's a 6-part programme view. It's on RT2 at the moment. It was on last night. It's going to be on for the next 4 weeks. It's called Schlín na Miogleach. Myself and my father went around in Beauty to 6 counties along the west coast of Ireland.
Yeah.
And we met musicians and singers and dancers. And we had great fun going around and spending time with friends and making new friends.
Yeah. As a Begley, do you come out of the womb playing a musical instrument?
We do, yeah, we do.
So I'd say you have no memory of life without music, have you?
To be honest, I can't remember not hearing music or feeling music in the house. But yeah. It's funny. I was late coming to playing music. I always love listening to music, and there's music always around the house, and musicians, and my father played, and my uncles and aunties, singers, and I was late starting. I had no real interest in playing myself until my late teens, until my older brother started playing guitar, Brian, and so kind of inspired me to start playing. I've been playing since, like, I kind of got addicted to it. So.
And were they pointing at you and, you know, going, look at him, he's very odd, he's not playing any musical instrument?
not because I wasn't playing any musical instrument.
No, for other reasons, right?
But I know they weren't not, like, I'm jesting, of course.
And then when you did take it up, why did you settle on the concertina?
That's a good question. I'd listened to this great concertina player from East Clare called Mary McNamara. I was very inspired by her. She's a great player. And my cousin Egon Lynch, I thought he was very cool. Like, and he played the concertina, and I loved the shape of it more than actually the sound of it, funnily enough. But it's strange. Back here in West Kerry, there's only a handful of people that played music.
And is it hexagonal or octagonal?
Hexagonal.
Right, right. And it's of course it's easier to transport than a full size accordion.
There it is, And sure, I say to my father and my uncles, and they're all accordion players. It's the concertina is a lot more. It's a lot more evolved instrument. It's very easy now to play the accordion in comparison.
All right, you didn't take the easy route,
no,
soft road, right? You have it there. Just give us a blast of it there. Would you play something for us?
Yeah, I'll play you something quick. I'll play a tune called O'Neill's Cavalcade. It's an old.
Now, how
march.
Long is it? Because I remember I was stuck in a broadcast van with a man called Neddy Vaughan from Kildare.
Oh yeah,
and he started playing the accordion. He put his head down. And I'll
close my eyes now. I'll come back to you in 20 minutes, maybe.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. You must have been there, Cormac.
I'm well used to it. I'll keep it brief, don't worry.
Okay, right. We're going to compete.
We're going to war. That's an old war tune from 1600. The O'Neills used to march into battle playing that tune, and they lost a decisive battle against the English down in Cork. But that was one of the tunes that they played into battle.
And I thought it was Horselip's Derry Doon.
They didn't cite O'Neill's Cavalcade at all, but that's where they got it from.
That's where they got it from,
yeah.
Right.
And they kept that to themselves.
It is, there you go. It's a great old tune, isn't it?
Almighty tune. It would psych you up.
Yeah.
It would definitely psych you up for battle.
You're out of breath. Does it take a lot out of you playing that?
I'm joking. No, it does. It's a big, heavy bass concertina. It's one of six bass concertinas in the world.
Right.
A very rare instrument. It's as heavy as an accordion. But
So give us the history then. There's only six of them in the world.
Yeah, there's a maker, Colin Rosalie Dipper, there in Warminster, in West England, just beside Wales there, and they make some of the best instruments in the world. But I came across this instrument in Japan maybe 5 years ago. And I was lucky enough to get my hands on it, and I ordered one in the meantime, and I have a second bass at home, but they're very deep sounding. They're like two octaves below the regular pitch, and there's a great
bass. Lovely. And I know you're in a studio, there's only one microphone, but I love the rawness of it there.
Thanks. Thanks so much.
And how many concertinas would you have, Cormac?
Well, I have 13 in total.
Right.
I wasn't lying when I said I got addicted to it. Maybe a bit of addictive personality.
And do they all have different sounds, different personalities?
They do. They're like people. Really, yeah. Like they've some of them are quirky, some of them are moody, some of them are deeper sounds. Some of them haven't got their voice broken yet, high pitched. So. Yeah.
So I love this. So you're getting into the camper van. How will people know where you're going to land on any particular evening?
So I'm asking people to go to my website. It's cormacbegley.com/beauty and to fill out a contact form. And since I put out the tweet two nights ago, I've had an overwhelming response, people signing up. And there's an option there for people to be notified when I organise a concert or if they want me if they want to host a concert. I have a background in organising concerts. I've been running concerts in Galway, sitting in St. Nicholas's Church, a concert series called Tunes in the Church. And this would have been the 10th year of that series, for concerts like 5 nights a week for the summer for 3 months of the year. And I also run like week-long courses here in Dingle, West Kerry, for the last five years. And since COVID hit, disappeared completely. So I'm trying to think of ways to create employment for musicians and artists. So when people go online, they can fill out this form, cormacbegley.com/beauty, and I'll email them maybe a week before, or once I schedule a location and a time.
Right, you'll email them.
I'll email them on the day where the location is, but it's going to be kept secret up until then.
And you're compliant to all the COVID-19 regulations, obviously.
Absolutely,
And it's outdoors, and more they're telling us to gather outdoors and not indoors, because that's where the harm's been done.
That's it,
indoors. Kat has been on. I watched that series with Cormac and his dad, and it was beyond special, the connection that they had, especially since they were travelling in such close quarters. I especially love the scene where his dad plays the accordion while having a seaweed bath.
Oh, yes, yeah. that was the first, anyway. That was the first.
I don't think that's been done before. I've seen a lot of people over the years get seaweed baths, but not quite playing the accordion. That is a first. So cormacbegley.com/beauty.
Beauty. And it'll also be available on the Facebook page, Instagram, Twitter and YouTube as well. So people subscribe to that. If you fill out the contact form, I'll notify you first, and so you'll hear about it first, and then maybe 24 hours after that I'll put up online.
It might be a lovely birthday present for somebody who's into traditional Irish music.
Yeah,
to get you to come along with Beauty and park up somewhere.
It could be, and also I'm hoping to have other artists and musicians play. Like for example, I play with a lot of different people. Like next week, I'm doing a music network tour with around the country with the Vagabonds, and on the 30th of September, I'll be playing the National Concert Hall with Keeping O'Reilly. I play often with Liam O'Malley, Liam O'Connor, and Lisa O'Neill, and I'd have people of that calibre, hopefully,
dropping in,
bring them around, and have them do concerts around the place. So
I'm not going to ask any questions about how tough it is, because we'll keep it positive, and that was a lovely positive chat. So I really enjoyed that, Cormac. Thanks again for coming into Radio and the Gaelic.
Slán.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
51551. Now, in studio, we're joined by Donegal man Killian McLaughlin. And Killian runs Wild Ireland, which is a wildlife sanctuary. And he is the subject, and so too is the wildlife park, of a new RTE1 programme, which starts tonight at 8:30, called Return of the Wild, The Bear Man of Buncrana. The Bear Man of Buncrana, Killian. The TV people give you that name, or
they did indeed. Yeah, I think it might have been coined in a newspaper some time ago as well. But it's a great name. It is very catchy.
Yeah, thanks for coming down.
A pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I watched the episode that's going out tonight, and what fascinates me is that I had no idea that such a place existed.
Yes,
and it's been an odd time, I suppose, with COVID and everything.
But
your life story is fascinating as well, and this is the culmination of, you know, a lifetime's interest and work.
Absolutely,
So bring us back to the start. We all loved animals as kids, but you had a particular interest.
Exactly, Ray. That's something that I always say. I think we're all born with a fascination for wildlife and the natural world. It's whether or not we retain that, or whether or not that's been nurtured. I think it should be nurtured in schools, and I think kids should be educated about the natural world, particularly the natural world that we have here in Ireland. Very often we focus on the subject of wildlife documentaries in Africa or Asia and with all the big impressive animals, but little do many people know that we had all these big and impressive animals right here in Ireland just a few thousand years ago that were unfortunately hunted to extinction. And I never learned about that in school, and I think that I wish I had have been, and I wish I learned about temperate rainforests and everything else, but you know, it's not part of the curriculum. I think I was lucky in that I was born into a family that recognised my interest in wildlife and encouraged me and nurtured that interest. And maybe
so what was the first animal you had?
The very first animal I ever had, well, we had a family dog, but my own first pet was a hamster called Ben. And that's where it all started. I think I was about 5 or 6 years of age, and really that's where it grew from there.
And you know, the way Dr. Doolittle and all that, there's always stories about these figures who have a special affinity to animals.
Yes.
Is that you?
I think some people are born with a gift, and the more time you spend around animals, they will educate you. You know, if you do something silly, you're going to get bitten, you know, and that's
because they're wild.
Exactly. And you're going to get an education, and you learn how to behave around them. You learn social distance, and every animal has an acceptable space between you and them that they'll allow you to get into. The wilder they are, the larger that space will be between you and the animal. And you learn all that. The more you spend around them, the more comfortable you become with them and they become with you.
And how did you develop then a name in the locality for a sort of a haven, a sanctuary for rescue animals? How did that come about?
So, I mean, I had a very understanding mother for a start that allowed me to take all these animals into the house and look after them. And I think once you have that...
But there must have been... Was there a first one? Was there a...
Well, Jack the Jackdaw,
Jack the Jackdaw.
A crow called Jack. I actually hand-reared him. He'd fallen out of a nest and I hand-reared him whilst I was doing my junior cert. So like any other baby, they need fed every 2 hours. So I was counting down the hours to the end of the exam to get home and feed the bird instead of going home to study for the next exam. So I lived quite close to the school. And then the funny thing is that the bird then used to follow me to school. And I think most people of a certain generation in Buncrana will remember Jack. When I went off to university then, poor Jack didn't know where I had gone. So he used to go to the school every day looking for me.
Oh, poor Jack.
He knew where my maths teacher's window was, and he'd often go up and peck on the window looking for me. But then he got to know that I would be home on the bus at 4 or 5 o'clock, and he would wait down at the bus and follow me home. So he was quite the character. He ended up then on Nationwide, of course, because he could speak, and people were shocked that a crow could say a few words. They're very good mimics, like parrots.
What did he say?
Hello. And I think he used to say various other words that maybe I can't repeat on the radio that he learned right, that he learned up around the school. But he was a character, he really was, and he would steal people's lunches. And I remember my old principal ringing me one morning and saying that I had to come and take the bird home because he was stealing people's lunches. And I remember my principal saying to me, "Tell him if he wants to come to school, he must wear a uniform."
So Jack started, and then you got a name locally.
Yeah, I think I had the name before that. You know, Jack was brought to me, and then various other foxes and otters and all sorts of things. And then eventually, you know, I had snakes as well. I always had a fascination with reptiles. And I had a snake that belonged to a drug dealer, believe it or not, that actually ended up in jail, and nobody would take this big Burmese python.
The drug dealer ended up in jail, not
yeah,
the snake.
Yeah, not the snake. Yeah. So nobody else wanted her. So I ended up taking her. Somebody phoned me one day and said they had a pet monkey, and they were being moved to New Zealand. And they couldn't take the monkey with them, and that was Susie. And Susie's still with me today. She's about 30 years of age, so she's nearly as old as I am. And she's old, and she's got a bent
so
over.
All of these were out in the back garden.
Yeah. And then
and you like
the school's got to know about it.
Well, they can't punish you retrospectively. So, but you're probably, you know, contravening health and safety and all sorts of things.
No, not really. Ireland's an incredible place where you need a license to keep a dog, but you don't need a license to keep a tiger in your back garden, believe it or not.
Brilliant.
I never had any tigers in my back garden, but you know.
But you had a monkey.
And I had four of them, in the garden, from various backgrounds, you know. And they weren't pets. I don't want to come across that these were pets.
No.
Like one of the monkeys I had or still have, used to wear a nappy, and they knitted clothes for him and things like that. And it was horrible, you know. And the first thing I did was cut them off him.
Yes.
And put him with a social group.
At this point, I should make it clear that you went on to study zoology.
Correct.
Third level.
Yeah,
and you are a conservationist.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, at heart. Yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
That you and sort of Joe Exotic are worlds apart.
Absolutely. You know. It's funny, I joked with my sister this morning. She's a fashion blogger, the Sequin Cinderella, and she would wear an awful lot of leopard print. And I said to her, because people do draw that comparison with Joe Exotic, and I said to her, if I'm Joe Exotic and you're Carol Baskin wearing all your leopard print. But no, look, Joe Exotic, I mean, the human side of that story is tragic in itself, but
yes,
the animal side is even more tragic, if you ask me. Imagine feeding lions and tigers from processed meat, salvaged from a dumpster. I mean, that is crazy. Mm-hmm. He claimed to be a sanctuary, but he was breeding cats for profit so that people could come and take their photograph. And, you know, that doesn't just go on in America. That goes on here in Europe as well. And in Europe, we don't have that breeding big cats and going and getting your photograph taken with them. But we do have a big problem with brown bears in this continent.
And that's where you got your, you know, the bear man of Buncrana, because you have three brown bears.
We have three brown bears at Wild Ireland, yes.
In Wild Ireland, yes. And tell us their story.
So the three brown bears started out life in a museum in Lithuania that's dedicated to Stalin and the Iron Curtain and all this kind of stuff.
And what's bears, the connection there? Go on.
I think bears are a symbol of Russian power or whatever. And this guy wanted them as an extra tourist attraction just to bring people through the door. So he had six bears, Ray, in a very small concrete cage cell, like a jail cell with iron bars, concrete caked in feces. And these six bears spent their whole life in that. They never had the opportunity to run or play or swim or do any of those things that bears might do in the wild. There's a charity called Bears in Mind that are excellent, and they rescue bears from all around the world. And they rescued the bears and they brought them to a place in Belgium called Nature Help Centrum. And then they outsourced them then, or outplaced them to their final new home at Wild Ireland, where they could live a very natural life. When they arrive, like, our big male, Dunica, is 450 kg. I would say coming up to the winter now, he's probably topped the scales over the 450, and he's big and he's impressive, and you would be really afraid of him if you met
what,
him.
What height is he when he goes up?
Legs. He's over 3 meters tall when he stands up.
Okay.
When he stands up.
So tall. So near 10 foot. Tall.
Absolutely, maybe even taller.
Yeah.
When I opened the sliding gate to let him out, Ray, of the holding pen, he put his foot out onto the grass, and I'll never forget it. This is a big, powerful animal. He put his foot out onto the grass and he lifted it off because it moved under his feet, and he had never experienced grass or soil under his feet. And when you see a big animal like that afraid of grass, it really hits you right in the throat.
Yeah.
And it took him a long time to come out and wander around, and his two sisters were with him. The sad thing was, Ray, that they couldn't confiscate the other three bears because he had paperwork for them. My bears were only confiscated because he didn't have the correct paperwork for them.
So the rest of their extended family
the
are still
three bears were left behind, and one has since died, presumably of neglect. But those other two bears are there in horrible conditions. But thankfully, my bears are...
There's a scene in tonight's programme where you go to the Natural History Museum and you meet that amazing man who we've had on the show numerous occasions, Nigel Monaghan.
Yes.
And he fills you in on the animals that would have roamed Ireland back in the day, and brown bear were one of the species.
Yeah.
And they have evidence there in the museum to prove that.
They do indeed. I got to hold fossils of Irish brown bears, and I tell you, you know, if an object could speak, you know, when you hold that fossil in your hand, you can feel the history. And this is a brown bear that roamed Ireland, fished salmon in our rivers, ate blackberries, and, you know, it's really quite incredible. And then Nigel showed me a wolf jaw as well, an Irish wolf, which I got to hold, and that would have been hunting deer right here in Ireland. And he even showed me, this is all in the documentary, he let me hold a little tiny bear jaw that was only a couple of weeks old. Bears give birth underground in the wintertime when they're hibernating, and this little cub was born underground and he never saw the light of day. He died in the cave 3,000 years ago, and archaeologists upturned this little jawbone. He's actually probably the last of his kind, or coming up close to
and
the
why
end.
Why did they become extinct in Ireland?
You see, this is the thing. It's very difficult to say when they went extinct or why they went extinct. We know that there was big land clearings for agricultural purposes, certainly. Humans arrived in Ireland about 12,500 years ago. it was believed that they arrived 10,000 years ago until they found a bear fossil that had cut marks which had been made by human tools. And when they dated that bone, it was 12,500 years ago. So that pushed human arrival way back. And then when you take that 12,500 years and you look at the youngest bone that they found, 3,000 years, that's 9,000 years or 9,500 years that humans shared this island with bears. Yeah. And that's amazing. And then wolves right up until less than 300 years ago when they were hunted to extinction. And the last wolf died in 1786 in County Carlow.
So your brown bears, it's, you don't have to heat them or anything like that. This is the perfect climate for them.
Perfectly adapted to the climate.
And the woodlands and all that is perfect for them.
Absolutely.
So Dunica, he goes to put his foot in the grass and recoils.
Recoils back onto the concrete.
How was it? That's how many, 18 months ago? Or
Just under a year ago. A year in October,
how was he now getting used to
it? Right, what he did then, this is heart-wrenching. If you had seen it, he pulled the soil up onto the concrete, and he stood on it there first to make sure it was safe to walk on, and then he wandered out. And it's taken the bears nearly a full year to learn how to swim. And that's amazing, because bears need to swim and hunt.
In the wild,
sand. It's one of the reasons that these bears can't go back to the wild, because they couldn't survive. They couldn't swim. They wouldn't know how to catch fish. So two of our bears now swim. One of them is going
still
into
wearing,
the...
Still
into
wearing
the,
armbands.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. She took... I tell you, it was a proud day when they took off their armbands and went
for
a swim.
They didn't have armbands.
No,
they?
Of course they didn't, but... one of them will go in now and keep her feet on the floor and sit down on a warm day. So I'm hoping she'll take off the armbands very soon and go for a swim. So, you know...
You've bears, you've wolves,
we've a pack
you've
of
deer.
Wolves. Yeah, there's deer. There's a lynx as well. I always say the lynx is the original Celtic tiger. This is a big yes. cat that we once had roaming this country. You've probably seen that in the clip this morning as well. Nisha, she's beautiful. And when you see her in the natural forest, it's fantastic to see. They went extinct a long time ago. Very difficult to say when exactly as well, because lynx don't sleep in caves like bears and wolves do. So when they die out in the open, their fossils or bones are washed away before they get a chance to fossilize. So there was just one lynx that was unfortunate enough to fall into a cave, and then the bones turned up there, and that's how we know that they were here. We've the wolves, we've the wild boar as well, and the wild boar gave birth over lockdown, and the little boarlets, as they're called, they look like humbug sweets. They're brown with stripes. They went viral. They were all over the news in America and everywhere, which was really, I think people were looking for a good news story, and the little wild boarlets were exactly what people wanted. We've an otter, we've red foxes, I have crane as well, and crane are really interesting.
And some of them are in enclosures, and then some of them are just wild around the place. Is that the way, or are they all enclosures?
Unfortunately, look, it would be lovely to open the gates and let them free, but for obvious reasons that can't happen. I have built the enclosures as large as I can to take into account as much of the natural habitat as possible. They live in the forest, but they are behind fences. Okay. They are behind fences, and that's an unfortunate thing.
This is a labour of love for you.
Oh, absolutely. It's a lifelong passion.
And people will... See tonight, you did law after zoology, went to England, practice over there.
No, I practice here in Ireland.
Oh, you practice here.
I'm
sorry, you came back. You met Katie.
Yeah.
You met Katie where?
In Dublin. Yeah, Katie's a dub.
And she's law as well?
She's a solicitor as well. And she moved up to Donegal, and she started to work in the family practice in Buncrana. And then we were
and
doing this.
You share a love of animals.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which it wouldn't have lasted if she didn't love animals.
I don't
as
think
much
so.
As you
no, I remember my mother saying to me when I was a young fella, "You'll never get a woman to put up with what I have to put up with." So I was really lucky that Katie was one that puts up with the. I mean,
and when did you get married?
We got married in December 2018.
Right. Okay.
Under
and
2 years ago.
While you were putting the whole thing together, you were doing up a house as well, and people would see that.
Yeah.
As well as. Me thinking about Tiger King when I saw the thing last night. I also thought of The Durrells, which we watched.
Yes.
And that's based on a book by Gerald Durrell. And you reminded me of him.
Yes.
You know of him?
I do. Gerald Durrell is one of my heroes.
Oh, right.
He inspired so many conservationists. He unfortunately passed away in 1995. But
tell people about him.
Yeah, so he was an author, and he had a love of conservation and conserving the animals that people maybe didn't get so excited about. So the little brown animals that he used to call them are, you know, the ones that they weren't the big impressive lions and tigers and everything else. And he set up the Durrell Conservation Trust in Jersey, and they have that Trust and that wildlife park in Jersey have saved so many species from extinction through captive breeding and reintroduction. The Mauritius kestrel springs to mind, the pink pigeon, and various other animals that are forgotten about. Madagascar was another place that he concentrated on. Maybe the lemurs, the ringtail lemurs that everybody loves and the cartoons are made about, but the ai is another lemur species that's quite ugly. They used to call it the witch's cat in Madagascar. But he started a breeding program for them and saved so many species from extinction. And his books are just brilliant, and he inspired so many people to become conservationists, and he certainly inspired me as well. And I hope through this documentary as well that I can show
inspire
people
others, yeah,
what we've lost in this country. You know, the wolf and the bear and the lynx are very unlikely to come back unless we really change the landscape here in Ireland.
And did you contact him or?
Yeah, so I was only 10 years old when he passed away, but his widow, Dr. Lee Durrell, she's still there running the trust. And my mother actually wrote to her when I was quite young, and she told her about my aspirations, and she invited me over to the zoo, and I got to go behind the scenes and see conservation firsthand. And I keep in touch with her, and I actually have a signed postcard signed by herself and Gerald, wishing me all the best as a young boy. And that's one of my most prized possessions. Yeah, it's a lovely, lovely little keepsake that I have. And I keep in touch with her and up to date on everything.
I can't wait to bring the family up to Wild Ireland.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Yeah. You're more than welcome. And I think when you watch this documentary as well, I mean, Shane Brennan and Moondance and Pascal Cassidy, the cameraman, they became part of the family, right? They were there. They were at the wedding, our wedding. They were there the day we found out that Katie was pregnant. And they really, like, Shane took a real risk because, you know, this could have fallen flat in its face because, you know, there's so many challenges to overcome, the finances, the red tape, the planning issues, you can imagine.
But your vision shines through the whole thing. I've only seen the first episode, but this is something you've been dreaming about from when you were arranging animals on the kitchen table at home.
Correct, you're
under 10.
As a little boy, this has just been my life's ambition. And it's not complete yet. You know, this is just phase one. I like to say that the animals are still living in puppy pens. I've loads more space up there that I'd like to expand and let them roam through the forest. And the future looks good. And, you know, it wasn't set up to be a tourist attraction or anything like that. It was set up primarily as a wildlife sanctuary. And I wanted to educate people, but I was thinking locally, but there was something about bringing these animals back, and they were once in Ireland, bringing them back, that has inspired so many. And I think it's captured everybody's imagination as well, that they're now back.
Well, it's a great watch. Return of the Wild, the Bear Man of Buncrana, who is Cillian McLaughlin. Cillian, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Good Marion. Thank you very much. 5 on 5 on radio.rte. On Cillian McLaughlin there. I'm delighted to have Cillian in studio. I was in his class in primary school in Donegal. He's amazing with animals and so generous with his time and very patient answering all my animal questions. Wild Ireland is such a great addition to Inishowen. Looking forward to the programme, says Jennifer. And Kevin says, Wild Ireland is fantastic. Well worth a visit. Well done and good luck to Cillian. And where is Wild Ireland, says somebody else? And it's up in Burnfoot on the Inishowen Peninsula in County Donegal, and it's on the Donegal-Derry border. And if you tune in tonight at 8:30, you'll see all that. Okay, joined in studio by psychologist Alison Keaton and psychoanalyst Ray O'Neill. Good to see you in studio.
Good to see you.
You were in with Catherine, were you, while
yes,
I was away?
Yes.
So this isn't your first time in studio. So
first time to see you.
Yeah.
It's March.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a long time, isn't it?
Yeah.
What about the psychology of wearing face masks, Alison, before we get to our listeners' questions?
It's hard. And as you were saying there, you know, it's like losing another sense, that you nearly have to listen harder, and you definitely have to work and express yourself more, because even you might be smiling under that mask, it's actually quite hard to tell.
Yes.
So I think we have to work extra hard. It's challenging. We're all going to be wrinklier, aren't we?
Because I would have thought that, you know, that we are drawn to people's eyes. And which the eyes aren't covered with a mask, right? But the mouth obviously sends out signals as well.
I think one of the things that's interesting with this kind of new situation we find is we're realising that actually we were picking up our cues in a lot of other ways, because it's a bit like they talk about somebody who becomes blind, how their hearing becomes accentuated. I think our reliance on eyes is becoming stronger because we don't have necessarily the mouth and the smile to look to as much.
Yeah. So you want to let people know that you are smiling behind the mask. So you raise your eyebrows and do all sorts of things. Look at my twinkly eyes, I'm really smiling.
We're smizing.
We're smizing, yeah. Okay, so we said you were coming in, so we've a good bit to get through. So let's start. Hello, Ray, Ray and Alison. I'm writing to you to get some advice on how to connect more with my husband. We have lost the closeness, fun, intimacy and happiness. We argue over small things and innocent comments can be misconstrued as being critical remarks. He seems to be constantly on his phone and is always messaging his large family or friends on WhatsApp or Snapchat, etc. This drives me insane, or checking emails or news updates is a constant distraction for him too. He is never without his phone. I feel like we've fallen out of love and I'd love to know how to fall back in love or just increase the closeness or spark again. We've two small children too and don't want our unhappiness to affect them. Yeah, so she says there, we've two small children and don't want our unhappiness to affect them. She's saying, I don't. It's not we don't want, because it doesn't sound like she's had this chat yet with her husband, Ray.
I think that that's a very good point to pick up on. Is, you know, perhaps they haven't talked about, you know, the nitty-gritty of what's going wrong here. But there clearly is some awareness between the two of them that whatever is going wrong, they don't want it to affect the children. Well, the best way to make sure it doesn't affect the children is to talk about it, because kids are sponges when it comes to silences in a family. They pick up on things because that's what children do. Like what we were saying about the cues,
yes,
because children aren't so familiar with language and literacy, they pick up on emotional readings so much better in many
body
ways.
Body language,
exactly,
all of that. Yes,
than adults,
yes,
do.
Yeah, yeah, so it's hugely important. We've spoken about this before, Alison, that the phone is going to wreck loads of relationships, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's like there's three on the couch sometimes, isn't there?
Yes.
So I think just bring it up. Sometimes people don't even recognise they're doing it. It is the smoking of our time, really, isn't it? And I don't think people sometimes, maybe he does, but maybe he doesn't. So give him the benefit of the doubt and talk to him about how it actually makes her feel isolated and alone, and that he's choosing his large group of family and friends. But there could be some intimacy issues there, that he finds it easier just to have a quick text with them rather than actually connecting with her. But the thing that jumped off the page to me was that the comments are often misconstrued. So there is stuff that needs to be talked about. And when, you know, there's issues that haven't been talked about openly, you get into this kind of cycle of negative sentiment override. So basically anything, even innocent, is heard negatively. So that to me is the flag that we have to wave here.
So it could be about, it really is about lack of intimacy and lack of having sex.
Talking. I mean, to get to the sex, you actually have to have the intimacy of saying, I miss you. I feel lonely. I don't feel like you love me.
Yes.
You know, those feelings. Yeah. That's the intimacy, the vulnerability piece. That's what I'm feeling from her. But maybe she just has to have that conversation and see where it goes. But you set your intention really, you know, you kind of wrap it up nicely and say, I miss you. I miss us.
But is that thing common enough, isn't it? Where the little things become big things, but it's not really about the little things. It's not about not emptying the dishwasher. It's not about that.
No.
No, it's about the fact that things aren't going well and this is just a symptom of it.
And she recognises she doesn't feel connected. She doesn't feel a sense of love or the fun. That she misses the part of them, perhaps, that was before they had children.
And what about regulations around phone use, Ray? You know, like leave it out of the TV room from 8 o'clock at night or whatever.
But again, it's like, because I always believe that we never stop being the children we were. And the best way to establish regulations with children is to give them a context for why that. So you're going to bed at 9 o'clock because if you stay up till 9:30, you'll be grouchy in the morning and then you'll be. And they go, oh, yeah, you're right.
Yes.
I might do this, but I know you're right. Thinking my old parents, God bless them. But that idea of, like, it's not about imposing a law. It's just saying, look, when you're in your phone, I miss you. You're not there for me.
Yeah.
And I just, it's getting increasingly lonely.
Yeah.
And so when Alison is talking, she's right about having that conversation. The best way to start impossible conversations or difficult conversations is to just say, this isn't impossible. I don't know how to do this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes if you appear to be the one who has the answers, you can be resented for it.
Yeah.
Whereas going with the question.
So it's showing a vulnerability.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I hope that works out and you're not on your own. I'd say, unfortunately, it's a story that's been echoed around the country.
The gorgeous thing in it, which is the statement that I would really invite her to either say or show back to her partner, is, I feel like we've fallen out of love and I'd love to know how to fall back in love.
Yeah.
We need hope.
Mm.
It's like all this COVID thing.
Yeah.
We need hope.
Yeah, yeah. Hello, I'm a female in my early 20s who's in a long-term relationship that I hope will be my lifelong relationship. My query may be slightly different to most. I worry I rely too heavily on my boyfriend for emotional support and understanding. I'm an independent, hard-working, completely self-sufficient woman in practical terms. When it comes to dealing with my emotions, however, I feel I expect too much empathy and understanding from him. I can see he finds my expectations difficult to meet. I would love some advice on how to curtail my demands on him and not expect so much. I'm working in healthcare and I like to think that I'm a compassionate person in tune with people's emotions. He works in business and has never had to go through any emotional hardship. Perhaps this is where our our mismatch in expectations stems from. Regard, that's an interesting one, isn't it?
Mm. I mean, what I'm hearing here is, like Ray was saying earlier, the child. So what emotional needs weren't met as a child? And she's looking for kind of this perhaps excessive reassurance from her partner, or maybe some of it's warranted. You know, it's figuring out the middle ground with that. The fact that she's aware that she's looking for this and why does she need this extra reassurance? You know, what vulnerability is that bringing up for her? Is she feeling worried that he's going to, you know, leave her or abandon her? What issue? It's actually not him. I think it is her. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that in a blaming way. It's actually great that she can identify the feeling in this. So I would just get her to kind of sit with what's actually going on here and what is she hoping that he will meet in her that perhaps she needs to meet in herself. Well, not perhaps. She does need to meet it in herself first.
Yeah, I agree absolutely with what Alison said. I will also add, because particularly again in the year that we're having, people working in healthcare, it's been exhausting.
Yes. Yeah.
It has been a particularly demanding time for students, for nurses, for frontline workers. So it's understandable when so much of your work life goes towards compassion and care for others, that reservoir, the give and take, you probably do feel you need a little bit more.
And there's a fear there as well that she's going to turn him off her. You know, and that thing, you know, it's derogatory, isn't it? Needy, that word.
Yeah.
You know, she's describing herself there without using the word as... But she's fearful that she's needy.
It's great that she recognises it. And as Ray is saying, you know, there's so much compassion fatigue and actual physical, emotional burnout. Mm. And we're only heading into more of it within the healthcare system that she feels depleted. So the question is, how can she meet these emotional and physical needs within herself? I mean, we're looking into a lot of people with post-traumatic stress.
Yes.
Coming down the line, or if they don't already have it. But as you said, let's move away from the sense of that needy thing, because I don't think, I know what you're saying and you're right, but it will make her feel shameful that she feels this way. There are real needs here.
I know, I totally know
what you mean.
And I think that in a relationship that's going to work, because she does say at the outset that I hope this will be a lifelong relationship, that there needs to be this sort of, cohabiting of needs. So like at one stage, somebody is going to be needy and the other person has to absorb that.
But you're right, Ray, because the more she pursues him, the more he will pull away.
Yes.
And then it proves to her, oh gosh, I actually was too needy.
Self-fulfilling.
It becomes self-improphecy. Yeah.
If I may speak up for the Irish man. Okay. Not every Irish man will pull away from that.
Okay.
I know that is the challenge. And it's, again, we're taking her anxiety and her fear, which is very real for her. But to trust someone, to be needy with someone is such a privilege.
Yes.
And if her partner values that, because in what she said, he hasn't complained. Maybe he is honoured and moved by the privilege that he's helping a frontline worker, that he's being her frontline on a domestic front. Mm. Because I absolutely, there's such stigma around neediness. And it took me decades to enjoy and let, first of all, myself need and then rely on somebody else with those needs.
Yes, yeah.
There's a privilege in that. So don't be ashamed of
it. Okay. Mm. And it's brilliant that you've actually written it down on paper. So that's a huge start and good luck with that. Okay. Ray and Alison, my partner and I rarely have sex. We love each other very much. Both find each other very attractive, but we have entered into a vicious cycle where I feel like I've been rejected by him a lot and rightly or wrongly took it personally, although he says he just has a lower sex drive than me. It has shook my sexual confidence big time, especially after coming out of a long, emotionally abusive relationship not long before we got together. Therefore, I don't initiate anymore, as I'm crippled by my fear of further rejection. In turn, I know by stuff he says, he employs, I don't want him anymore. When he does rarely become flirtatious, it's almost like I freeze internally and brush it off outwardly, as I have myself so locked in this mindset of feeling not wanted. Carrying around these feelings and not talking about them is really taking a toll on my mental health, and I can tell on his too. I know it sounds ridiculous, but I find it painfully difficult to bring up and have an open conversation about it, as I suppose I think I sound totally pathetic. Any tips for approaching this issue with my partner? Thanks. Who wants to take that?
I think there's so much to that. And yes. But again, this is what it is to have sex in a long-term relationship. And as I always say, a long-term relationship is anything over 12 months. We're programmed. We're not educated around sex in Ireland or in the world. We're programmed for sex to be this kind of activity, sport, thrill. We're not educated that sex is something intimate, something beautiful, and something that actually is grounded in awkwardness. Unfortunately, pornography doesn't communicate awkwardness, but all of us in relationships know that body parts go to the wrong places and elbows hit faces and people fall out of the bed, even when you're not trying that hard. It's called being human. And again, it's a bit like with the earlier person, not to be ashamed of the awkwardness, but to actually bring it there. So the only way to kind of approach this conversation is just to kind of go, I'm scared about having this conversation, but you're too important and our sexuality is too important to not talk.
Yeah. And they find each other very attractive.
Yeah. Well, you see, I don't think it's about this couple. I think it's like one step back, and we go back to
her former relationship.
The emotionally abusive relationship that she had not long before. So she hasn't healed.
Yeah.
And how could she? And when she freezes, what I'm hearing is trauma there. And these are very strong words. She feels rejected. She freezes, like she's having very strong physiological responses. And in one way, she wants the sex, but in another way, when he actually comes towards her, she's like, she's frozen. So, I mean, it's really important that she addresses what it actually meant to her to be in that emotionally abusive relationship, how it affected her, and to work through that therapeutically so that she can let that go. Because I don't think that is what the problem is in this relationship. She's bringing it.
She does say it has shook my sexual confidence big time. But she could be mistaking, you know, what's going on for a confidence
thing. she's feeling rejected by him. Then she's taking it very personally. Like, these are very strong words, but I feel that they are possibly older wounds from an emotionally abusive relationship. Yeah. Like, that has a massive impact on a person.
So what's your advice to her then?
I would talk to somebody.
Yeah.
I really would, because these are issues that they won't magically go away. And these people love each other and they can work through this. But I think it's coming from the first relationship.
Okay.
I think one of the things, sorry, Ray, again, is that sexuality and sex doesn't have to be like, when you'll often hear couples, and I mea culpa as well, when you go, oh, I just don't have the time, I'm so knackered. It doesn't have to be a 9-hour marathon session. It can just be a 5-minute snuggle.
Yeah.
It can just be kissing for 2 minutes. Like, there's lots of things you can do. Mm. And so rather than putting the demand or pressure on him or feeling it on yourself, just again saying, look, if you're up for it, could I get a hug tonight or in bed?
But the longer you leave it, the less likely it's to happen.
Absolutely. The dry rot sets in.
I wish you didn't use that.
But I like Ray's idea. Like, you can build up the oxytocin. You can build up the love hormone by simple stuff. Start with what's missing. Are you giving each other a kiss in the morning and when you leave? You know, are you giving each other a hug? Are you actually holding each other's hand at some stage? The intimacy has to start somewhere.
Yes, yeah.
You know?
Okay. I really hope that works out, because it sounds like you have the foundation of a lovely relationship. Ray O'Neill, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alison Keaton, thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll see you soon. Mind yourselves.
Thanks, Ray.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
I think we have time for a bit of this before we go to Frank Greeley walking from Ballyhornis to Dublin. Christy, where are you? Christy Moore, and the reel and the flickering light. And it is Daddy Longleg time, so that's quite apt. Now, Frank Greely is walking from Ballyhaunas to Dublin, and he's sort of a third way through. Are you, Frank?
I am indeed, and indeed Christy Moore was there in the bank before he took off on the stage.
Yeah. That's where he worked. That's mad, isn't it? That's a coincidence.
He did.
Yeah, Bank of Ireland, wasn't it?
The Bank of Ireland, and then he, when the bank strike came, he went to England and he never came back to the bank again.
Yeah, a loss to the banking system, but a gain for the music industry in Ireland.
Absolutely.
Frank, great to talk to you. People will know you from, of course, you're running, and I was telling them yesterday that you've introduced the Daily Mile to Ireland. So schools...
Yeah, with Athletics Ireland, we're pushing that all the way,
Now, tell us why you're walking from Ballyhaunas to Dublin. Ballyhaunas is your hometown.
Ballyhaunas is the hometown, but I was born prematurely in the old Coombe Hospital back in 1951.
Right.
And I was born there, my brother Tom was born there premature as well, in 9 years before me. And then my mother had lost a baby in between him and me being born, a girl. And then when I was six, my brother Gerald was born, and he only survived a few days.
Right. So there's a strong family connection to the Coombe.
Strong family. Indeed, two of my daughters, Laura and Sarah, have been born there, and Laura's having her first baby there in October.
Right.
So a big, strong connection there. That's one of the main reasons, because at the time, I was only 6 years old, there was new life in the house. Then after that, there was silence, and then there was a lot of anguish and sorrow and stuff. And then there was silence again, because no reflection on my parents, but in that era, I think, families who might have lost infants and stuff, they buried their grief. Nearly felt that my brother was buried at home as well as in the little graveyard. And it had a big effect on me for a good part of my life.
Mm.
My parents went into some depression afterwards, and I carried that into my early 50s until I got a lot of help in a man called Dr. Mark Murphy up in St. Patrick's Hospital. And I feel I got Recovery Road there, I think, and now that has led to Gratitude Road. And I'm doing something, I think, special to give something back to the Coombe that gave my brother and myself life, or helped to give it anyway, all those years ago.
That's lovely. It's a long old walk, though, Frank.
When you break up a walk and have good friends, which I had, Frank Fahey there from Fitwalk Ireland, Phelan Kelly, the man who's coaching a lot of young athletes now, they've been with me the last number of days. And when you have company on the road, you know, it's great.
How many kilometres or miles is it?
It's over 200 anyway. We're breaking it down into normally I'm doing about 10 miles a day.
Right, that's doable, isn't
it? And that's in small bites, but it's very much when you're reaching out and when you're... Now, we're going to be hitting... the Royal Canal Way very soon, maybe later on tomorrow, up along the whole Waterways Ireland section there, and that's going to be off-road anyway, so that's going to be brilliant, you know.
That'll be nice. You're in Lanesborough now as we speak, are you? Or have you left Lanesborough?
Yeah, I walked from Roscommon to Lanesborough today.
Right.
And we had a lovely lady, Mary Feeling from Dublin, came down and joined us today as well, and pulled in there and then came back to Roscommon here for a little bit to eat. Because of the social distancing and everything, we're basing ourselves in Ballyhaunas until tomorrow, and then every day I'll go back to Dublin after that.
I see. So you're walking and then going...
To play it safe, you know. And
so we've about a minute, Frank, and I've spoken to you about this. So gratitude, hugely important, and that poor young fella, he was only in his 30s, who died of cancer. That was one of the messages he wanted to send from his deathbed, is to have this attitude of gratitude.
Yeah, and I believe that, you know, gratitude and negativity, they cannot coexist. So if you can get on Gratitude Road, I think it's the real answer. It has been life-changing for me, Ray, you know, really, since I grabbed onto Gratitude Road, and I read a great book there, Declan Coyle's The Green Platform, that helped me hugely as well.
We'll get the name of that and we'll put it up on our website.
What
we'll take away from this little chat, and we'll talk to you again, Frank, is that gratitude and negativity can't coexist.
Absolutely. Right. And if you can get on Gratitude Road and give back a little bit.
Yes.
You know, we all have been lucky in our lives, and give back a little bit. It means a whole lot to people you're giving it to, but in giving you receive a lot too.
Frank, mind yourself. We'll talk to you before you reach Dublin.
Great, Ray. And it's always a pleasure, and it's great. And I really appreciate you getting in touch with us on the road.
And if you see Frank along the road as he makes his way to Dublin, hoot your horn and put your hand in your pocket. That's it from us. Mary Wilson is on the way. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday evening.
It's the Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.